This podcast is sponsored by Cellar Plan from Berry Brothers and Rudd, collecting fine wines for future drinking.
Welcome to the Spectator podcast. I'm Isabel Hardman. In this week's episode, we'll discuss how elections across the world have been taken advantage of to give more power to corrupt leaders. We also talk about the international persecution of Muslims and ask why don't young Corbynites care about anti-Semitism. First, while the world has been reeling from news of Cambridge Analytica's political interference, two academics have been following the trail of shady election rigging across the world that go far deeper than social media. Professor Nick Cheeseman at the University of Birmingham and Dr. Brian Klass at the LSE have visited developing democracies from Asia to Africa to Europe. In this week's cover piece, they explain the extent of election rigging in these countries and what we, in mature democracies, can do about it. So Nick, who is rigging elections and how are they doing it?
Well, a surprising number of people are rigging elections. One of the things that we find is that actually in many parts of the world now, more elections are being rigged than actually could be said to be free and fair. And there's a number of different categories that we identify. I mean, some are people who really hold, you know, almost wholly authoritarian elections. So these are elections in which the context involves human rights abuses, you know, high uses of violence, all the kind of tactics you might imagine. But there's also a set of people who are doing a much better job of pretending to be Democrats, but nonetheless consistently making sure that they're returned at the ballot box. And we refer to them as counterfeit Democrats. So both dictators and counterfeit Democrats are able to rig elections and to get away with it.
Brian, this sounds a lot more serious than the row we've been having about Cambridge Analytica and Facebook.
Yeah, so I think the British public is waking up to the fact that these manipulations are commonplace in the rest of the world, and it's an ugly wake-up call that they're happening here too. At all the elections that we observe or that we have studied, virtually none of them are completely free and fair. And so I think it's a question of degree, and it's a question of how strategic these partners are being and how they're working with British companies to try to do the dirty work that they've been doing for much longer. Now, they're getting smarter, they're getting savvier, they're using new technology to rig elections, but in much of the world, in the sub-Saharan Africas of the world and Middle East and Southeast Asia, elections have been stolen for decades. And the West has largely either turned a blind eye to it or been sometimes complicit in endorsing very poor quality contests. So we're hoping that the rigging that has been unfolding in this ongoing saga about Cambridge Analytica makes the British public worry a little bit more about how Western players influence democracy or subvert it elsewhere in the world.
So is it the case, Brian, that elections are being rigged more extensively as a result of the technology that some of these dictatorships or politicians have?
So it gives them more tools. You know, if you think about the sort of standard rigged election in the 1960s or 70s, if they were being held at all, you know, you have henchmen from the regime stuffing fistfuls of ballots into ballot boxes. Now it's harder to get away with that. So we talk in the book about strategic rigging, where despots and dictators and counterfeit Democrats all use these sort of savvy techniques to be more stealthy in their rigging. And they're getting away with it more because of these new techniques. So one of the examples we use that's low technology is using pens with disappearing ink in Ukraine, where people in opposition areas voted and then the ballots appeared blank. That is on the low end of technology. On the high end is things like absolute micro-targeting of voters using misinformation and disinformation that sways voters to pick choices that they wouldn't otherwise normally choose.
Now, some of this research must have been quite risky. I mean, Nick, were you ever in danger whilst researching the book?
Not really us. I mean, I think the people we talk to in the book are often in danger. The people that we're engaging with are often democracy activists. They may be opposition leaders. And for those people, supporting democracy and competing in elections actually does involve risks to their lives. And one of the sort of most worrying chapters of the book is about political violence and the intimidation of opposition supporters. And there are a lot of countries around the world in which elections are actually extremely violent events for candidates and their supporters, in which people know that if they put their head above the parapet and challenge the government, they're likely to suffer human rights abuses as a result. So I don't think the risk really is much to us, although there have been a few hairy moments here and there over the years. It's mainly to the people that we're talking about who are trying to tell us their story because they're frustrated that what they believed was going to be an opportunity to make their countries better through the ballot box and through democracy is being subverted, and they feel that nobody is listening.
But you are making pretty strong allegations. So do you get
much comeback from the government who you're making these allegations against.
That has happened. I've been branded a so-called professor of democracy by the government of Zambia, for example, for a few pieces that I wrote that were suggesting that jailing the opposition leader on trumped-up charges of treason maybe wasn't the best way for that country to take its politics forward. I've had some pretty sharp words from governments in other countries as well, yeah. But as I say, I think it's very important to say that Brian and I are very lucky because we're able to come back to a country and write a book from a country where we're relatively safe. And we're always very conscious that the people we leave behind don't have that safety. They don't have that exit option. And so that's why the book is dedicated to them.
Brian, there are lots of organisations that observe elections to reach a verdict on whether they're free and fair, such as the OSCE, for instance. Are they really awake to the scale of the rigging that's going on?
Sometimes they are, and sometimes they're being outsmarted. So there are this sort of cat and mouse game between observers and election riggers, where the observers come up with an innovative strategy to try to detect something, and those who rig elections come up with a smarter strategy to get away with it. At the same time, there is also the sort of willful complicity of Western governments at times for geopolitical reasons endorsing poor quality elections. So one of the examples we talk about in the book and in the Spectator piece is in Azerbaijan in 2013, there was an iPhone app produced by the regime, supposedly in the name of transparency, to show real-time results. But those who downloaded it the day before the election found that the results had already been pre-populated. Now, that sounds like an absurdly rigged election, and it is. But Western observers praised that election. Many people from the U.S. Congress and also from European governments that sent observers said this was a free and fair election. They said it was very orderly voting. They praised it. And the reason for that is primarily geopolitical, that Azerbaijan is important in terms of natural resources. So there's this sort of dance between observers and election riggers. Sometimes they want to condemn and they get outsmarted. Other times they don't want to condemn at all because it's much more convenient for their politics to simply turn a blind eye, endorse the election, and then enjoy the spoils of a more favorable relationship with that country.
You don't sound fully in favor of that.
No, I think this is an abomination of democracy, and it's something that if people in the West care about democracy, they should insist that their governments actually put pressure on these regimes who are subverting democracy in other countries and oppressing their people with the willful support at times of our own governments.
And Nick, finally, what can other countries do about these elections? If they find themselves often caught up in diplomatic relations where they don't want to condemn certain countries because they're geopolitically important, can they do anything else? You mentioned aid in particular in the piece.
Well, I think one of the things that we have called for is for a greater use of the strategic power of democracies, of those countries who are democratic and want others to be democratic, to use their economic influence to promote democracy and to do so in a more genuine way, as Brian says. I think the second thing, though, is that in order to do that, those countries, and here, of course, we're talking about countries like the United Kingdom and the United States, they need to get their own house in order. You know, we've seen recently lots of accusations about breaking campaign spending regulation in the UK, not just in terms of the Brexit vote, but also in terms of regular elections. British political parties routinely break campaign spending regulations with relatively small punishments. So they don't have a great leg to stand on when it comes to going abroad and lecturing people about democratic standards. So I think one of the things that needs to happen is we need to get our own act in order. We need to look at democracy in the United Kingdom, United States, before we start talking to anybody else about democracy abroad. But then when we do look abroad, I think we need to think about the implications of the actions of our own companies. We need to think about what people like Cambridge Analytica are doing, and we need to have much tighter regulation of them, not just for what they're doing at home, but also for what they're doing abroad. And then finally, and perhaps most significantly, I think we need to get real to the dangers of allowing elections to be rigged and to the multiple ways in which they're rigged. And I think at the minute we tend to focus on one or two different ways of rigging, and it's very difficult to comprehend the whole range of the strategies available to dictators and counterfeit Democrats, including new strategies such as election hacking. And that's where we hope our book will come in as a helpful tool for those who are trying to defend democracy and protect elections, are the kind of strategies that can be used. And in the book, there are, you know, hundreds, I would say, of different strategies that can be put in place to try to protect elections. But it's also important to say that we don't think this is going to be easy. We know there's a lot of very good people out there trying to do this. There's a lot of great people working for democratic nations and democracy promoting organizations all over the world who are trying to do this. And part of the reason they're not successful is not that they're not trying, it's not that they're not brave, it's that this is a very difficult job. And the dictators and counterfeit Democrats that they're up against are very smart and are investing far more money than they have in making sure that they stay in power.
Thank you, Nick and Brian. And if you want to find out more, do check out their upcoming book, How to Rig an Election.
What are you drinking this weekend? Start a cellar plan with Berry Brothers and Rudd, and soon you could be uncorking something out of the ordinary. To start your cellar collection, visit bbr.com/cellarplan.
Next, as aid workers prepare for the coming cyclone season in Rohingya refugee camps, Dan Hitchens asks in this week's magazine, when will we stand up for Muslims? It is not only in Myanmar that they are persecuted. In Sri Lanka and India, Buddhist and Hindu nationalists violently pursue the Muslim minority, and in the Middle East, more moderate Muslims remain the biggest target of Islamic extremism. Dan, who is the deputy editor of the Catholic Herald, joins us now, together with Rupert Short, author of Christianophobia, A Faith Under Attack. So Dan, tell us a little bit about the piece that you've written.
Well, it's about how this is an age of religious conflict, and we've seen that very obviously with the rise of Islamist terrorism, but there's also been a rise in violence against Muslims in Sri Lanka, in India, and most notably in Burma, where there's been what some UN officials are calling a genocide. You have to be careful with reports because no one's been into the country because they're not allowed into the country, but the reports from NGOs and from the UN suggest that there have been really just unspeakable atrocities, hundreds of villages set on fire, children killed. And the stories that are coming out of refugee camps indicate that there might be something like a genocide that's happened. Part of what's disturbing about that is that it's the same kind of forces that exist in India, in Sri Lanka, where over time a Muslim population has been excluded, in the Rohingya's case, excluded from citizenship, excluded from society, and become more and more an outsider. And then you have this terrible outbreak of violence. And I think there is a larger picture here that more and more it is religious tensions which are dividing politics in a lot of countries.
And Rupert, in your book Christianophobia, you argue that Christians are just as persecuted as Muslims, if not more. So is it the case that actually all religions are being persecuted now by a secular majority, or that all religions are persecuting each other?
I take Dan's point. I think it's great to talk about the persecution of Muslims. And at every point in my own book, I do try to reference the persecution of minorities, even though the main focus is on Christianity. Sadly, though, I still think that Christians are the prime victims numerically. It's partly because Christianity is, of course, the world's largest religion. But it's also sadly because Christians have never enjoyed full equality in Muslim majority societies. And across a very large belt of the world, from Morocco to Pakistan, Christians are really up against it, I'm sorry to say.
Dan, do you agree with that?
I would completely agree with that. I mean, you know, people who work in the field of religious persecution, when you ask them this question, they would say, well, you know, I don't want to draw comparisons, and it's not something where you want to have a sort of competition to be most persecuted. But I don't think there's any question that in terms of the number of countries, the number of millions of people affected, anti-Christian persecution is the majority of religious persecution in the world. And I mean, you know, just one example, I'm on a mailing list for a group that records sort of violence against Christians in Pakistan, and it's like, you know, day after day something comes
in
about
daily
lynch
email,
violence.
Isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You're on the same
I get it
list.
Too.
Yeah, and it's appalling. And that's just one place. You know, one of the worst in the world, but it's not a dissimilar picture in Syria, in Nigeria with Boko Haram, in, you know, dozens of countries where to go to church on Easter morning, for instance, is taking a bit of a risk, as we've seen in the last couple of years. So I definitely wouldn't disagree with Rupert, but I do think there's a bigger story which is missed because, particularly in secular Britain and secular Europe, we sort of forget how big a role sectarian tensions play in other societies.
But we are seeing religious tensions rising in our own society, aren't we, Rupert? We had the Jewish community protesting outside Parliament this week at the Labour Party's handling of anti-Semitism. So it's not just in countries where it's the government that's persecuting religious minorities. It's also actually in countries where the government hasn't taken a position on this.
Yes, what's that line? Religion makes good people better and bad people worse. Of course, because it's a mark of identity, it can be put to corrupt use in the way that all sorts of marks of kinship bond can be. With the decline of strong political ideologies, at least of the kind that we saw in the 20th century, I think there's a strong case for saying that religious harmony is going to be one of the very big challenges of the 21st. My hope would be that religion carries the antidote to its own poison, as it were, that there are narratives in all of the major faiths to nourish cooperation, dialogue. But it's a tricky one. We've used the word persecution, but I think it's important to qualify that with the word discrimination as well, and also to provide some numbers. There are about 2 billion Christians in the world, and in my book, Christianophobia, I suggest that about 10% of the global total of Christians face some kind of menace. Now, does that mean that they're all having guns held to their heads? No. In a country like Turkey, the real problem is with discrimination. It's that Christians are second-class citizens. There will be a glass ceiling to your career in very many respects if the word Christian appears on your identity card. And that there are many other restrictions which I go into my book. The other thing I'd just like to mention is, apart from the fact of the persecution and discrimination, the way that it's reported, the hierarchies of victimhood in the West, which mean, and I think this connects with your point about anti-Semitism, it's rightfully fashionable to be a persecuted something else. It's not very fashionable to be necessarily to be a victim of anti-Semitism. In the Labour Party, there's a sense that that issue has been rather overlooked. And it's not very fashionable to be a persecuted Christian. And I think we can look at the subject through mistaken lenses, for example, through the lens of gender, which the BBC, among other organisations, makes a great deal about at the moment. Let me give you an example of the way that that can distort a story. Several years ago, a Sudanese convert to Christianity, you will recall, was forced to give birth in shackles. And the way that that story was represented by the BBC, among other organisations, was, should the British government be giving money to a government which treats women in this way? Well, of course, her treatment had nothing to do with her gender. She was treated harshly because she was a Christian, and had she been a man, the treatment would have been even more harsh. So I'd like to take the chance to ask people to think about removing the blinkers as well.
Dan, is this partly because actually we've talked about the persecution and we've talked about discrimination? Is it actually that persecution in this country is quite different to persecution in countries such as Turkey, such as North Korea, for instance, such as China? And actually we don't fully understand the magnitude of it.
Yeah, I mean, to some extent, it is beyond imagination when you think of something like the schoolgirls kidnapped by Boko Haram a few years ago, where it's another example of what Rupert is talking about. There was a whole other angle to that story that they were, I think I'm right saying, Christian schoolgirls, and that they were
Christians, and that wasn't really mentioned.
Right, yeah. And that was a huge aspect to the story and to the whole conflict in Nigeria. So I think it is on another level. At the same time, there is a dynamic where exclusion from society and the seeds of violence do come together. I mean, for India's Muslims, for instance, they are disproportionately likely to be poor, to be unemployed. And you're also seeing with that often, you know, outbreaks of violence. People are killed every few months on suspicion of possessing beef. Something goes round on social media. And kind of alarmingly, there are sort of allegations that to various degrees, the authorities are complicit, they turn a blind eye, they don't prosecute the victims, and that even, you know, very senior Indian politicians have fairly close links to some pretty unsavoury movements. So the things do go together, the exclusion from society and violence, and we do have to look very carefully at the signs. But in some ways, talking about persecution in the West and talking about persecution in Pakistan or or Syria, we really need two different words, which isn't to downplay the kind of pressure on Christians in this country, but it's a distinct phenomenon.
But when you say that for Christians and for Jews in this country, it's much harder to get a hearing when complaining about persecution, I'm sure a lot of British Muslims would say, well, perhaps people are more alive to the idea of Islamophobia, but our lives are still pretty darn hard because people think of us with great suspicion whenever we get on public transport with a big bag, for instance. And actually, in wider society, apart from the sort of chattering political classes, people are deeply suspicious of Muslims.
Yes, I thank God for my very close friendships with a good number of Muslims, and I really feel the strength of that point. Seems to me that there are two mistaken narratives. There's the clash of civilizations idea that says that Islam is a more violent, a more martial kind of faith, which overlooks the fact that the vast majority of Muslims have no truck whatsoever with violent extremism. And then there is the narrative that seeks to exculpate the fact that sadly 80% of all the terrorism in the world at the moment is Islamist related, and to put that just down to politics. And I would want to steer a middle path and to say that the trouble with Islamic fundamentalism is that it isn't really traditionally Islamic. It's a bit like Christian fundamentalism in the deep south of America. It has more to do with the culture wars of America than it has to do with anything connected with traditional Christianity. Now, there are resources within Islam for detoxifying the stories that are told by the extremists, and they are going to renounce violence not for secular Western liberal reasons but for good Islamic reasons, and those Islamic reasons do exist.
Dan, there would be some who would argue that actually religious minorities can persecute other groups. So, for instance, in this country and certainly in other countries, people in homosexual relationships feel as though they're being persecuted by Christians, for instance.
Yes, I mean, obviously that's a big tension is between the LGBT community and LGBT rights campaigners and the church in this country. And I guess, you know, accusations of persecution are thrown in both directions. Certainly, you know, as a Catholic, I think it is a huge concern that a lot of people feel. You know, if they're opposed to gay marriage, they can't say that in their place of work. That is very difficult for that point of view to get a word in politics. And on really a host of other issues where it's often Christians, but not only Christians, who hold a view on abortion, for instance, there's a kind of silence on transgender issues at the moment. And I don't think the answer can be for both sides to say we're being persecuted at each other, but I do think there probably has to be more openness in debate about those questions.
We're at risk of sounding a bit like a Lib Dem fringe panel asking,
always
why
risk.
Can't we just get on? I mean, how can this really be solved?
I don't know, but I think
without being Lib Dems.
Without being Lib Dem.
Another, well, persecuted minority.
I don't know. Maybe there's room for some Lib Dem wisdom. I do think there is a risk of driving religious groups out of the public square, which, you know, would be bad, partly, you know, if you think the Christian teaching happens to be right. But I think from a more cynical point of view as well, the amount that churches, you know, and indeed mosques and synagogues and religious schools do within, you know, to just hold the fabric of civil society together in terms of education and social services and so on is huge. And we can't really exaggerate the extent to which civil society relies on religious groups. So I think if you then tell people, well, actually, some of your deepest convictions, you know, about the truth of your religion, about the truth about human sexuality and gender, whatever, they're not welcome. And, you know, you could get a knock on the door from the police if you express them. That is going to push religious groups to the margins of society, and I don't think that would be good for anyone.
Thank you, Dan and Rupert. And finally, Labour has been dealing with a fresh round of anti-Semitism accusations this week, as news broke that Jeremy Corbyn had defended an anti-Semitic mural as free speech. Alistair Thomas, one of our former interns, was disheartened by how little Corbynites in his generation care about anti-Semitism, and writes about the phenomenon in the magazine this week. Is anti-Semitism simply passé for the left-wing youth? Alistair joins us now to discuss, together with Michael Sigalov, news editor at Huck magazine, who wrote this week that Jeremy Corbyn is no anti-Semite, but he did F up. So, Alistair, why don't young people care about anti-Semitism? What do they care about instead?
I think young people would say that they do care about anti-Semitism. I think the problem is that when it appears to them, they don't recognise it as such. I think they see other things being more important, such as Islamophobia, such as the socialist cause. I think anti-Semitism to them seems like this peripheral issue that doesn't have the same importance as some of the other ones that they care about.
How has that happened?
It comes down to, a lot of it comes down to Zionism as a sort of theory. I think they often confuse Jewish people and Zionism, a term they hugely misunderstand, by the way. And therefore, I think, see Jews as this slightly less authentic minority, something that has power within the elites of government and within capitalist structure. They see it all as this great conspiracy.
So that sounds as though there's a lot of anti-Semitic tropes right there. If you say that Jews are this sort of powerful elite that have controls of various functions, it sounds as though people are unaware of their anti-Semitism.
I think so. And I mean, when you see some of the statistics of the general population of the UK being somewhat anti-Semitic, it's about 30% of the population who hold certain anti-Semitic views. I think there are levels of anti-Semitism. I think it's important that we do, you know, educate people as to what anti-Semitism is, that you can't just talk about Rothschild banks controlling the world, really, and get away with it. I think the problem is that because there are levels of it, it becomes difficult to distinguish between what is really dangerous and what is in the back of a lot of people's minds who don't know better.
Michael, you're on the left. Do you recognise this picture of perhaps casual anti-Semitism?
Yeah, well, I would definitely differentiate between kind of the more obvious, explicit signs of anti-Semitism associated with the far right, you know, the Nazis, the EDL, fascism, and then more subtle, I wouldn't say nuanced, but certainly less obvious and less evident examples. I certainly don't think that a naivety towards those more subtle nuances is a thing of the left or of young people. I think that in general our society are unaware. I looked at this mural this week, and to me it was relatively obvious as a Jewish Labour member what the problems were. But I spoke to some of my friends and colleagues who are in the left or on the right or in the centre or aren't engaged at all, and some of them didn't instinctively recognise what the problem was.
Do you think that could have been the case for Jeremy Corbyn, given his long-standing involvement in the debate around Israel, that he wouldn't have noticed the quite clear anti-Semitic signs in that mural?
Well, I don't think his involvement in Middle Eastern politics is entirely relevant at all. As a man who's in politics, he should have been aware. And it was a shame. I think it was a real shame that he commented on there. I'm inclined to believe him that he didn't notice properly. I think his history, his record speaks for itself. But the kind of the bigger question that's already come out of this, which worries me, is that we're speaking about Israel and Zionism in the first place. It's not something to me is particularly relevant. I don't think that's part of the conversation that needs to be had. This anti-Semitic trope relates to Nazi Germany, the Protocols of Zion. These are things that have come long before the State of Israel appeared. There's a whole separate conversation our community, and I mean the Jewish community there, needs to be having about Israel, about Zionism, the way we perceive our identity in relation to a country. It's a problem, in my opinion, when you have the Chief Rabbi Ephraim Mervis writing in the Telegraph that Israel and Judaism are one of the same. But that's a separate conversation to be had by the community.
Mm. So, Alistair, you say in your piece that British Jews are often asked to apologise or explain the actions of Israel.
Yeah, and I think the problem is that with Corbyn's anti-Semitic issues that he's had, they're not over Israel. The problem is Israel gets brought into the conversation. As soon as a Jewish person complains about anti-Semitic treatment, Palestine becomes the topic. It becomes the way in which the hard left talks about Israel and Palestine means that it has to be brought into everything to do with Jewish people. And it's through their misunderstanding of what Zionism is and through how Israel acts in the world that they cannot seem to separate these two entities. So I think what's important is if the left have a better understanding of Zionism, that we will start to see that differentiation, that understanding of the nuances of the conflict and also of Jews' place in the world.
Michael, in the Board of Deputies and Jewish Leadership Council's letter, the allegation was made that Corbyn is basically indifferent to anti-Semitism in the way he's not with other forms of racism. Do you accept that, or do you think that's unfair?
I don't think it's fair that he's indifferent. I think maybe there's a different approach that's needed. One of the things we often forget is that Jewish people in this country make up a very small proportion of society. I think it's 0.5%. That's a very small amount. So the majority of people in their day-to-day lives don't interact knowingly with that many people identify as Jewish. That's often very different to people now who identify as LGBT or are black or Muslim. So I think that's part of the issue, is people don't necessarily understand or know some of the kind of more nuanced approaches to understanding anti-Semitism. But I don't think it's fair to say he's indifferent. I think what we've seen in the last few years has been a concerted effort to try and take this on. The Takrabarti report, which is the only party to do an investigation and produce a report into dealing with anti-Semitism. Now, don't get me wrong, clearly there's more to be done here. And I think it's a real shame, actually, and I said this before, that the reason that we're talking about anti-Semitism at the moment is because of a Facebook post from sort of 4 or 5 years ago, when actually only 2 months ago statistics came out from the CST, the Community Security Trust, to say that anti-Semitic incidents in the United Kingdom are at the highest ever level in modern history. Violent assaults up 34%, and that number at 60% in the United States. I wish that everyone speaking about anti-Semitism now was speaking about it 2 months ago when those figures came out.
Well, this isn't obviously a problem of Jeremy Corbyn's creation, but as Michael says, it's not going away. So what needs to change, Alistair, for anti-Semitism to go down?
Within the party or generally?
Within wider society and the party.
I think within wider society we are seeing the rise of anti-Semitism, as Michael says, and it's difficult really to know where to start with that, because it has so many disparate and discrete ways of entering society. Particularly on the left, I think it does need to be tackled by Corbyn with action. There have been so many...
You don't
many...
think there has been enough action?
No, definitely not. There's been statements, there's been plenty of statements that are trying to calm Jews down about this, but there's nothing so far that Corbyn has said that's a concrete promise.
Do you accept that, Michael?
I think there's more to be done. I wrote this in a piece for The Guardian today, actually. One of the key things the Labour Party needs to do is to firstly put itself in order. I don't think that Labour has a greater problem with anti-Semitism than any other organisation.
What, even than the Conservative Party?
No, I don't think it does.
I think
but
it
I certainly
does.
Don't think... I think it has to hold itself to a much higher standard as a progressive political party. But I also think that Labour needs to now realise that with a party of 550,000 people, there will be people who slip through the net. That means they need to be able to deal with those instances faster, but also invest in education. It's not good enough to say that anti-Semitism exists in our society. They need to find proactive ways to tackle it, both as a party in opposition, but also for when they enter government. If that means investing in better political education in schools, then so be it.
Now, why haven't they done that up to this point? I mean, anti-Semitism was a problem under Ed Miliband. He would often get complaints from the Jewish community that they were facing the same sort of insults that they're now facing under Corbyn.
I mean, those complaints didn't just come from Labour members. They came from the Jewish community more broadly under various governments, including the Conservative government of David Cameron and Theresa May. I mean, remember the way that Ed Miliband was treated by the press in the bacon sandwich debacle.
So you think that was anti-Semitic?
Yeah, I do. I think the way he was treated there was. I'm not here saying there's no anti-Semitism in Labour. I think there clearly is, and what we've seen this week is an expression of that. But my concern now is to turn to how we solve that, and I think there are definite ways that the Labour Party can take action, which I believe they are. I believe there's a real genuine desire to do what they've set out in the letter to the JLC and to the Board of Deputies.
Alistair, you looked like you were disagreeing with Michael just then when he said that this wasn't more of a problem in Labour than anywhere else.
The problem is that when Corbyn spoke about these pockets of anti-Semitism, those are the same pockets that he's been standing in for 30 years. He has been associating himself historically with racists, anti-Zionists, who claim to be supporting the Palestinian cause, but really, you know, they're doing nothing of the sort. You know, he has taken money from Iranian state TV. He's defended Reverend Stephen Sizer, who said that Israel was behind 9/11, and Raed Salah as well. This is a track record that shows that he cannot be a friend to Jewish people, not truly. I think he does have a problem with anti-Semitism. Now, he may not recognise that as his own anti-Semitism, but it is there because he does not seem to see it when it's staring him right in the face.
He does seem to have a very unfortunate social life, Michael, and he just keeps bumping into lots of anti-Semites in a way that most of us don't. I mean, some of us do have friends who we suddenly find that we disagree with, but not on a sort of regular basis like Corbyn.
Sure. I mean, we have to accept a caveat here. Many of these incidents for a long time ago, when Jeremy Corbyn was a backbencher meeting lots of people, but that's not a defence of him.
Because he hasn't really changed his views on anything since becoming Labour leader, has he? That's one of his sort of selling points, surely, is he's a man of principle.
But his position in Parliament and in the party has certainly changed. The responsibilities he has, you know, as a backbencher, he was meeting with many people. But this isn't me defending his choices there. I think that's incredibly worrying when we found those things out. But they're not new. And there have been, each of those instances have been explained already. And I'm willing to trust. My concern is very much looking at the future, what the Labour Party is offering and saying about anti-Semitism now. And I've got every faith they can do something. And I do take issue with one of the points that's been raised today, which is that young people, young left-wing people are the problem. I don't think that's true at all. I think, if anything, what I've witnessed in the fallout from the last few days is older people online, who I don't know what party they're in, but people who I assume associate themselves with Corbyn or the left, people who aren't part of any movement I'm part of, who are blindly defending the mural and what's happened, tend to be older. I think young people, on the most part, are much more aware, or at least are willing to listen. The people I've then spoken to in the last few days, the people who've read pieces I've written or hopefully seen me speaking about these issues, if I've explained the tropes that are in there that maybe they've never come across before, I think they're starting to understand and realise what that means and are listening. And I think that's the majority of Labour members.
Alistair, you were at the protest in Parliament Square this week. What was it like?
Very Jewish. It was polite but angry. There was a lot of self-deprecating humour. But it was obvious that people were angry and they wanted change. And I think the fact that the Jewish community did come out to protest is so telling of the concerns that it has over this problem. We're not a community that does tend to take to the streets in the same way that others do.
Michael, you weren't at the protest. A lot of Labour MPs were. Do you think it was a valid protest, or would you have been more on the side of those who turned up with the alternative protest in support of Jeremy?
I mean, to me, the whole thing was quite bizarre. Not that people turned up, I'm really glad they did, but the premise of that protest should have been to tackle anti-Semitism. And from what I could see, people on both sides, in inverted commas, were there to do just that. I think it's perfectly reasonable for the Jewish community to raise concerns about anti-Semitism, not just within the Labour Party. And I'm really pleased, actually, that our community was mobilising themselves. You're right, often at the moment, in this country at least, that doesn't happen enough, and I think it should do more. At the same time, I do take issue with some of what was said. I wasn't at the protest, I haven't heard this speeches, but certainly in the letter that was written. I do think there's work to be done, but I don't accept there's no safe space in the Labour Party for Jewish people to be involved. I don't accept that's true at all. I mean, as a Jewish Labour member, I've never found that. The many MPs who work in Parliament, the councillors, the Momentum members, the Progress members who are Jewish, don't all feel that's true.
Some do, like Luciana Berger has received a horrible amount of anti-Semitic abuse over the years and is currently receiving that now.
Of course, and that's not a defence of it. I mean, what I'd firstly say is that sadly a lot of our MPs from all different variety of backgrounds, I mean, Diane Abbott as a prime example faces that, and that's nothing to be defending. If those people who are giving that abuse happen to be in the Labour Party, they should be chucked out without a second moment's thought.
Finally, Alistair, do you think that actually the problem is that intolerance is rising more generally, that actually you've got Islamophobic incidents rising? We've got a piece in the magazine this week about religious persecution. Actually, people are understanding one another far less.
I think so, and I think the way to deal with that is to combat it when you see it. And I'd just like to say about young people as well, because I think this ties in, and what I was trying to say in my article is that yes, it is older people who do seem to be more hostile to the Jewish community, but it's young people's responsibility as self-proclaimed anti-racists to call that out when they see it. But instead, what I've seen online and within my group of friends is silence, is a complete lack of desire to take responsibility and say, no, this is wrong, what the generation above us is saying and their conspiracy theory is wrong. Instead, we just get a kind of dead silence on the whole issue.
Thank you, Alistair, and thank you, Michael. And that's all for this week. You can subscribe to the podcast on the iTunes Store. And if you enjoyed this week's Religious Focus, you can also subscribe to Holy Smoke, our religion podcast, where this week Damian Thompson talks to Stephen Bullivant on the death of American Christianity. And you should also pick up the magazine, where you find all the pieces discussed today, as well as Freddie Gray on the international shady dealings of Cambridge Analytica's friends, Tristram Hunt's diary, and many more. We've also got a special offer for podcast listeners. Subscribe to the magazine for just £1 a week at spectator.co.uk/Moscow and receive a free ticket to our upcoming event with Andrew Neil, What Does Russia Want? Tickets are £35 for non-subscribers. Thanks for listening, and do join us again next week.